Torah in Motion would like to thank Stanley and Ilana Emerson for their contribution to the Architects of Modern Orthodoxy series.
Okay, I'll just a couple things, as is our want, clarify things from last time. I had a chance to finally read Moshe Sokol's article, and he sets the issue exactly the way we did. He says, in discussing the academic approach versus the traditional approach, he says each approach in its own way is capable of alienating the contemporary religious reader from the biblical text. Historical inquiry does so by overly emphasizing the text's remote origins. Traditional inquiry does so by overly emphasizing its classical and medieval exegesis. And then he goes on, quoting someone, and talks about how a contemporary exegete is required to examine things in the light of contemporary knowledge. If he does so, then he is following in the footsteps of the ancients, even if he disagrees with them in a thousand details. However, one who only copies the ancients, shutting his eyes to newly discovered facts and knowledge, is abandoning the ways of the ancients. So that's interesting. And we spoke a lot about Shabbos and problems, and it was interesting that in the last week a couple things appeared. One was in the foreword, how that there are now two Supreme Court justices, clerks to the Supreme Court who are Orthodox. And in that article, it mentioned the difficulties that it used to be going to law school. It talked about Nat Lewin when he was in Harvard. Not only were the exams on Shabbos, and therefore for them not to have exams on Shabbos, they had to hire their own proctors, but there were classes on Shabbos at the law school. And he recalled how after davening, they all would run to go to class, and just like Rav W. T. Hoffman suggested, you can't take notes, obviously, but to be there in class. I also have to clarify something I said. In that question we dealt with Rav W. T. Hoffman, I said that education was not required for youth. It turns out, actually, that in Prussia, there's other areas of Germany, but in Prussia, from the 18th century, at least in theory, education was required. Now, in the United States, it wasn't until the 20th century that all 50 states had required a public school education for elementary school, and this began in the mid-19th century. But in Prussia, it began in the 18th century. It wasn't until 1871 that all of Germany was united in this. But there were places that Jews, that everyone was required to go to school, so I thought that's interesting. One other news item, how in France right now, observant Jews are having all sorts of problems with exams on Shabbos, etc. So again, we can be thankful that we live in places like the United States and Canada. What we're going to do today is we're going to finish up with a number of important things, including perhaps the most influential in areas of halakha, Rav Hoffman, and that's his issues of intermarriage, and then we'll move into the Maritz Chayes. So let's pick up exactly where we left off. With Rav David Zvi Hoffman, you see, as with Hildesheimer and the rest, a recognition that orthodoxy is now the minority, and he continues in Ettlinger's tradition, and he rules also that Shabbos violators today no longer have the status of idolaters, or of, you know, they're our brethren, and they're in the fold, because they don't know any better. Basically, as we said last time, all the problems dealt with by modern-day Poskim were dealt with Hildesheimer. He even deals with civil marriage. He might be the first, or certainly one of the first, to deal with civil marriage, and he is actually strict. He believes that civil marriage is a real marriage, and you need a get. That doesn't mean that he would assume that the children are mamzerim if a woman divorces, but he does state that you need a get for civil marriage. He had to deal with as well burying someone in the cemetery who's not circumcised. As I said last time, this became a big thing in Germany, where circumcision went out for many of the assimilated. The rabbis have always put sanctions on these people. In fact, there's a very famous passage in Halachic Man, where Rav Soloveitchik records how his grandfather was once at a meeting of great rabbis, and they were thinking about putting all these sanctions on people who don't circumcise their children, not allow them to be buried in the cemetery. And the Rav quotes his grandfather as saying, we don't put sanctions on Shabbos violators, and of course Shabbos violation is even worse than not circumcising. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said that, I don't know where you get these things from. What gives you the right to put a sanction on someone who doesn't circumcise his son? And the Rav concludes that from a political and practical perspective, and as an emergency measure, no doubt the majority was correct. That is, the other rabbis were trying to secure circumcision. And yes, we understand that people today, they're Mechalei Shabbos, they don't know such a terrible thing, but everyone knew that not circumcising was a terrible thing. At least we can secure that, so they wanted to put all sorts of sanctions. The father who wouldn't circumcise his son, he couldn't be buried in the cemetery, you know, all sorts of things like that. And the Rav says they were right. Then he continues, though, however, on the basis of the pure halacha, Rav Chaim was correct. And he would not sacrifice this halachic truth even for the sake of realizing the noblest of ideas. This is the old Rav Chaim Brisker approach, that all he knows is what the halacha says. And that these ideas that the rabbis come up with new conceptions to try to stop irreligiosity, he doesn't know from that. And if the Gemara and the Rambam don't say that you put these bans on people, then you don't put these bans on people. And that's one of the reasons that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik could never be a good posek. And the city of Brisk had to hire a posek, Rav Simcha Zelig Grieger. Because Rav Chaim, he was such an original mind that he wasn't followed by convention, that you can't have modern practical halacha working like that. It's like the Rugachever. But this is, as I said, the famous passage in Halachic Man where the Rav is speaking about Ish Halacha, this true halachic man who's not bound by convention, by what other people are doing, only bound by the pure halachic truth. And that leads to all sorts of unusual rulings and where you differ from everyone else because you need to be concerned with these issues. So there's always been a conflict between the Brisker, the pure halacha. And if you look in Rav Zevin's Ish Halacha, he says that is precisely the reason why the Briskers, Rav Chaim in particular, did not decide practical halacha, because they would overturn the halachic system as we know it. They would come up with all sorts of new ideas, going back to the Rishonim, using their original minds. They're not concerned with convention and what the Shulchan Aruch says and the rest, if they think the Shulchan Aruch is wrong. Now, W.C. Hoffman, he acknowledges that this is a very stringent approach to put sanctions on someone for not circumcising their child. How does the child? It's not the child's fault. He says we also put sanctions on the child. If a child dies who hasn't been circumcised, we don't bury the child either in a Jewish cemetery. Why is it the child's fault? The child doesn't know any better. And here you see this notion of boundaries, boundary maintenance. Adam Furziger in his book speaks a lot about this. Shabbos violation, that was something you couldn't get people to fall into line anymore. The 90% of Germany was Michael Shabbos. But circumcision was still something that you could have influence on. And therefore, yes, it's unfortunate for the child who doesn't know any better. I guess it's maybe not unfortunate. He's no longer alive, so he doesn't know any better. But the point is that you need to make these harsh decisions to help bring people into line. And it was still a time where people cared about being buried in Jewish cemeteries and being allowed into synagogues, etc. Hoffman also was asked about going to the army. German Jews went to the army, and of course, the halachic problems, can you enlist in the army, what about Shabbos violation? And again, he shows, and you see from this how important it is for German Jews to be part of cultured Germany, that yes, you can enlist in the army, and you certainly cannot get away, you can run away if you're drafted, and this is part of your patriotic obligations, and there are no Shabbos problems because going into the army is permissible, and once you're in the army, you can't help it. Whatever they order you to do, you have to do. German Jews felt very much a part of Germany. When World War I began, they, like everyone else, they were lovers of the fatherland. So you see a sense of what it was like in Germany there. Finally, we have to deal with the issue of conversion, which I said last class was going to be the important issue, and the hot-button issue. The controversy comes down to a few points, and it's the same controversy that the rabbis are screaming about today. And they've been screaming about for well over 100 years, and it all begins in Germany. Because in Germany, that's where you have the first breakdown, and you have this new phenomenon of conversions for marriages, etc., etc. So what are some of the issues? Well, first of all, how welcoming should the rabbis be to converts? I'm sure many of you know about the Syrian. I spoke two nights ago in Brooklyn to a Syrian community, and I was very surprised to hear all the Syrians who don't like their community's approach. I was speaking about other Sephardic approaches, and it's quite surprising. But the Syrians, as I'm sure many of you know, do not accept any converts for marriage whatsoever. They do accept converts if the conversion was done as a child or had nothing to do with marriage, but they don't accept conversions for marriage, and basically they don't accept converts really very much at all. Even though technically you might be accepted, they don't want to intermarry with you, all sorts of things like that. But leaving aside the Syrians, how welcoming should rabbis be of converts? Should the rabbis make it hard to convert or not? How observant must the convert become? That is, how observant should the rabbi set up his system when he's training the convert that the convert should become? The Talmud says that converts need to accept the Torah. And if they don't accept the complete Torah, then they can't be converted. But what does that mean, to accept the Torah? Clearly, converts are going to be like everyone else. They're going to commit various sins. And so in what sense do we say, if you say a convert one day will miss a mincha, I mean, does that mean you don't convert him? I mean, what does it mean that a convert needs to accept the Torah? And let's say someone says they will accept the Torah. But at the same time, this person says, yes, I accept the Torah. The Torah says you cannot work on the Sabbath. But I realize that at present, I have a certain job, and I can't get out of it. I hope one day to be able to. But I tell you, Rabbi, that at least for the near future, when I have to, I will work on Shabbos. So he accepts the Torah. He accepts that the Torah says you can't work on Shabbos. But he also says that he is going to work on Shabbos. Is that okay? Or is that what we would say, tarte de satre? Is that a contradiction in terms? Now, what if the Dayanim think he's going to violate certain laws, big laws, let's say? Are they obligated to ask him or her? And if they, or can they just assume that he will, and even if the person says otherwise? What's the role of the Dayanim? Can a Dayanim refuse a convert, even if the convert assures them that the convert will keep the laws, but the Dayanim have their doubts? And let's say they do convert him, and immediately upon conversion, it seems that the convert was not telling the truth, and the convert is not observing Shabbos, the convert is not keeping kosher, the convert converted for some other reason entirely. Is the conversion invalid? And if we do say that the convert has to accept the Torah and observe all the mitzvot again, what does that mean? If the convert's going to tell Lashon Hara, does that create a problem with the conversion ex post facto? Well, then, what's the difference between what would create a problem? Is it Shabbos? That if the convert says, we find out immediately that the convert never even intends to keep Shabbos, does that void the conversion? And if so, why Shabbos? What about other laws? I mean, these are all questions that have been discussed by the post scheme for hundreds of years. There's a big book, or no, I shouldn't say big, not that big, 200 pages by Tzvi Zohar and Avi Sagi, citing the various opinions that really run the gamut. And in modern times, they've really come to the fore. If you recall, those who are with us for Rav Herzog, we saw that Rav Herzog actually thought the halacha changed in this area, lachumras, more stringent. Because according to Rav Herzog, and this is how he understood the Talmud, it's obvious that someone who converts and is not a righteous convert, that is, doesn't follow the laws really, or at least to any real extent, it's still a valid conversion. But Rav Herzog said that that only applied in a traditional Jewish community, where everyone was religious, and the person would be brought into line, because if you're in a Jewish community, you can't violate these laws, you sort of have to be brought into line, even if the person did not have the right intent on conversion, and maybe wasn't completely medaktek in mitzvot. So Rav Herzog really stressed intent. If someone converted, and we know the intent is incorrect, the conversion is regarded as a good conversion ex post facto. The Gemara already says this. The Gemara doesn't speak about how many of the mitzvahs you do, but the Gemara says if your conversion is for the wrong reason, ex post facto it's a valid conversion. Rav Herzog daringly said, maybe today it's not true. Because today you can convert, and you could say, look, Eilat Omer, he's a good Jew, I'll be like him. And you don't have to observe any of the mitzvahs. So Rav Herzog thought that maybe when the Gemara said that, as the Rambam said, that a conversion, even for the wrong reason, is a valid conversion, that's because when you converted willy-nilly, you're in a community where to be part of the Jewish community, you have to observe laws and be part of the structure of the Jewish community. But today, you can convert and move to Tel Aviv or move to anywhere, and you will have nothing to do with the Jewish community. There was an example, for those who remember Rav Herzog, the classes on Rav Herzog, where Rav Herzog speaks, as I said, quite daringly about updating Jewish law, but lachumra, stringently. But these are all sorts of questions that need to be dealt with. Other important issues. Do we make distinctions based on family situations? Maybe we have certain standards and we require certain things for the typical run-of-the-mill convert, But if someone's already in a situation with a non-Jewish person, a romantic situation, maybe then, or even civilly married, we lower the standards. As I said, these are the sorts of questions that were everywhere in Germany. You didn't have that much in Poland. In Poland, you didn't have non-religious Jews going to the rabbis to be married. You didn't have, because Polish Jews were so separate from the non-Jews and Jews in Lithuania, you didn't have assimilation. In Vilna, everyone, the non-religious married the non-religious, but you didn't have intermarriage. Now, he first takes this up in Melamed Lahoil, Volume 1, Number 83, and he takes up a case that's very common today. A Jewish woman had married a Jewish man, civilly, and she was already pregnant. Now the husband wants, for whatever reason, he wants to convert and marry the woman according to Jewish law. The problem is that already the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch says that you cannot convert people for the sake of marriage. Here I have the Shulchan Aruch. It's in Yoredeya 268:12, and it says if a convert comes to convert, bod ki nachara, we have to look into them. Maybe they came for monetary reasons. Maybe they came because they thought they get certain prestige. And then it says if it's a man, we have to examine if he has his eye on a woman, and if it's a woman, if she has her eye on a man. And if that's the case, we don't convert them. However, if you do convert them ex post facto, it's a valid conversion, but l'chachila, ab initio, we don't convert them. So, as they would say in yeshivas, pashtus, you can't convert such a person. However, this is what you call the pure halacha. The halacha, when you're sitting in the base medrash and you come up with the rules, that's the pure halacha. In fact, even the Rambam himself, when confronted with a case like this, he ruled that you do convert the woman, and he said his idea was that we violate a small infraction for the larger infraction, to prevent the larger infraction. So the Rambam himself acknowledged that in the famous tshuva. And Hoffman also raises the point that this halacha makes a lot of sense if someone just comes off the street and wants to convert because he wants to marry a woman. We wouldn't convert him. However, in the case that he's confronted with, they are already civilly married. Whether or not we convert the man is not going to change anything. They're already civilly married. If a man comes off the street, let's say he wants to marry a Jewish woman, and therefore he wants to convert because she won't marry him unless he converts, we don't convert him. She doesn't get married. So that's, he says, what the Shulchan Aruch is speaking about. But when they're already in a situation where our not converting him is not going to prevent their relationship because they're already in the relationship, therefore, he says, you can convert the man. In fact, he says, it's better if you do this. You validate his status. And this is actually a positive thing because the man could have remained married with her in an intermarriage. But he wants to be Malim Bakodesh, to use Hanukkah terms. He wants to go up and create a better state for himself, and she wants him to as well. He says, in that case, there is no problem converting him. Now, there are poskim today who use similar logic to say, even the previous case, that if someone comes in today's day and age, and he's going out with a non-Jewish girl, or he wants to marry a Jewish girl, he's not Jewish, that we assume that in today's day and age, if we push them away, they're going to be together anyway. In today's day and age, love conquers all, or they're going to go to the conservative or the reform rabbi. And therefore, many poskim say that it's best that at least we do it right. And in today's day and age, when a couple is going out, when they're in a relationship, that is the equivalent of 100 years ago when they were actually civilly married, and we do everything we can to convert the person, of course, make it a valid conversion. Hoffman says, if we don't convert the person, the man in that case, the children will grow up not Jewish. That is, halachically, they're Jewish. But since the father's not Jewish and he's going to celebrate Christmas and everything, the children are going to be lost to us. Therefore, we do something we wouldn't usually do. We convert the husband for the sake of the children, for the sake of the wife. Yes, Rabbi Kelman.
I was just going to say, whenever I have read through the tshuvas of the Melamed Lahoel, I'm sort of left with the distinct impression there isn't really a Kabbalic mitzvah here. He just says, you know, I mean, he sort of says they have to keep, you know, Shabbos and Kashrut, but you don't get the feeling like he's He says we have to convert them because the situation is worse. New Kabbalah Bar Mitzvah, he doesn't really address it.
Well, that's what I'll talk about right now, next paragraph. And then especially in a future paragraph, he addresses it in another tshuva. He does. And he concludes this tshuva, Rabbi Kelman, I don't know if he has Ruach HaKodesh, but he knows the tshuva very well. He concludes that the Beis Din has to speak to the man, and he specifically mentions, he doesn't mention Taras Mishpach, although in another tshuva he does, he specifically mentions Shabbos and Kashrus, and he says that they should try to get him to promise, to give his solemn word that he would follow these laws, but he doesn't say that this is a requirement, and obviously most people who are intermarried are not going to be immediate tzaddikim. Now, I will get back to the question, what about the notion of Kabbalat Mitzvot, that everyone has to accept the Mitzvot when I deal with another tshuva, because there he actually raises this issue. What then do we do about the obligation, which is a requirement, that at least it's a requirement of Chachila, b'diavad, after the fact it might not be a requirement, at least according to the Rambam, but ahead of time we have to get commitment to acceptance of the Mitzvot, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Remember, by the way, acceptance of the Mitzvot is a little bit fuzzy, though. The Gemara, and this is in the Rambam, says that before someone converts, you tell them a few big mitzvot and a few small mitzvot. And the Rambam adds that you tell them principles of the faith. We don't actually sit down with them and tell them all the mitzvot in detail. So Shabbos and Kashrus are a few of the big mitzvot, you could argue. But we'll get back to that in more detail in just a minute. Now, today, I think a Beit Din in this situation would make another requirement, or at least request a solemn oath, that the child will be given a Jewish education. The child will be sent to a Jewish day school. It used to be that the Haredim wanted nothing to do with intermarried people. And we've seen an enormous change in the last 5 years. Because the Kiruv movement has changed all this. Everyone you meet in Kiruv, if they're not involved with a non-Jew, their children are, their brother and sister are, and the old approach doesn't work. I know someone who runs a Kiruv minion, and it's full of people intermarried. So the old approach of shunning them won't work. So the Haredim now have adopted a model of trying to be makariv and trying to convert the non-Jewish spouse. Although my sense is that they still require more than the old modern Orthodox approach was. And not just the modern Orthodox approach, even what the Haredim in Israel used to acquire. The Dayanim in Israel were always Haredim, and they required much less. You all know stories about people converting in Israel. And when we begin next semester, we'll be talking about Rav Uziel and Rav Shlomo Gorin, and they were really the two big figures. Rav Unterman also, who argued that in the state of Israel, you do not need the same standards. Rav Unterman says this explicitly, that when he was in Chutz Laaretz, he had very, I shouldn't use the word standards, he had very high requirements. However, in Israel, his requirements were much lower, and we're going to discuss that, because that became a big issue in Israel, and in the last couple of years, there's been changes. And these changes have made great controversy. Now, I think Rav David C. Hoffman's tshuva is the standard psak in the modern Orthodox world, at least it has been. Yes, the Israeli rabbinate in the last few years have increased standards. The RCA went along with it. We're going to see in a few minutes some more stuff, and then we can talk about the RCA. Perhaps the RCA went along with it because they were forced to go along with it, because otherwise none of their conversions would be accepted in Israel. The Haredim have conquered and taken over the Batei Din in Israel, and they are forcing their standards. I don't want to call them higher standards. Let's call them more stringent standards, because for reasons I'll get back to. I mean, it's like the equivalent we talked about last week, to say that if the kashrus organizations today don't permit peanuts on Pesach, we're going to say that these are now they have higher standards. It's not higher standards. It's just different standards, maybe stringent standards. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says you could have peanuts on Pesach. He does not have low standards. That's his understanding of the psak. It's a bizayon Torah to say that people like Rav David C. Hoffman had low standards. They had different standards based on how they understood the halacha. And they were mako in conversion because they were machmir in other areas. The famous thing was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. He was very liberal when it came to people on Yom Kippur eating. If they felt a little bit ill, he would say, eat, eat. So they said, why are you so liberal, Mekel, when it comes to the laws of Yom Kippur? He says, I'm not liberal when it comes to Yom Kippur. I'm machmir. I'm stringent when it comes to pikuach nefesh, saving of life. It all depends how you look at the matter. But there's other issues we need to discuss, other cases. The last thing I pointed out, though, the modern Orthodox always had that approach, that when it was a person involved with a non-Jew, you don't discourage conversion. It wasn't just the modern. That was Ramosha Feinstein's approach. That was Ryakov Kamenetsky's approach. That is, we don't go out looking for them, but if they come to us, we don't follow the same idea of pushing people away. We try to convert the person. What to do prior to marriage? Do we then try to discourage conversion? Here, I believe there will be disputes. There certainly are disputes between the Haredim and the more modern, and there might be disputes in the modern as well. What do you do when a guy comes with his non-Jewish girlfriend? Do we immediately try to get her into some program, teach her about Torah, see if we can get her to accept Torah and create a real marriage? Or do we try to push them away? My sense is that many rabbis believe that once they already have the non-Jewish girlfriend, it's too late. It's not like we're not in the shtetl here. And now is the time to try to work with them if you want to try to create a bais neman. But I am sure there's some rabbis who think that that's going too far. Certainly the Haredim will have nothing to do with people, as far as I know, before they convert. Hoffman has another groundbreaking tshuva on conversion, and this tshuva has the distinction, if you want to call it that, of being specifically rejected by Ramosha Feinstein and the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav, who didn't really deal with Acharonim, he specifically rejects it, and Ramosha Feinstein, Igros Moshe, says, rejects it in very harsh words. So harsh, Eino Nachon Klal, or something like that, that in the Ma'an El Igros, the Sefer we spoke about, that is very critical of the Igros Moshe, at the beginning of it, he has a list of all the places that Ramosha Feinstein speaks in his mind disrespectfully about Acharonim, about great recent sages. And the point of this is to show everyone that Ramosha Feinstein has no respect for Gedolim, and this is all part of the effort to delegitimize Ramosha Feinstein. And the way Ramosha speaks about the Malamud Ohel, that's one of the examples he gives in the introduction, that this is not how you speak about Poskim. But that was Ramosha's derech, to speak very sharply, and he says things like about Poskim greater than the Malamud Ohel. This tshuva, which I'm going to talk about right now, rejected by Ramosha and the Rav, was, however, the basis of a very important and controversial tshuva of Rav Shlomo Goren that shook the Torah world. Rav Shlomo Goren had two famous tshuvot that shook the Torah world, the Langer case and the Seiden case, and his ruling in the Seiden case was based on the Malamud Ohel. And also Rav Moshe Malka, Moroccan Posek, who came out to Vayim Tshuvas a few years ago, he relies halacha mice on this tshuva. So what's the case? Remember, according to Rav David C. Hoffman, our job is to try to convert the non-Jewish spouse in an intermarriage. However, what do you do in a case where the man is a kohen? The halacha is clear that a kohen cannot marry a divorcee or a convert. These are halachot, incidentally, which show the difference between the conservative movement and the orthodox. Because the conservative movement, when they were still very halachic, they abolished this. How could you abolish this halacha? It's an explicit halacha. At the end of the day, the conservative movement has always, in their legal theory, they've always held room for conscience. And this is obviously a halacha which rubs people the wrong way, but from the Orthodox standpoint, it's halacha, and you surrender yourself to the halacha. The Rav spoke about things like this. The Rav says how it bothers you, but you surrender. There is this idea of conscience in the conservative movement that if all else fails, if you can't, even if it's black-letter law, and you can't find heterim in the normal way of doing things, you can fall back on conscience. And that's what happened in this case, and they abolished this halacha, and it's a valid marriage. If a convert marries a kohen, the marriage is chal, the marriage takes effect. And it's the children are chalalim, and so is the kohen, as they can't have the privileges of being a kohen. I mean, today people don't think it's such a privilege. They can't marry who they want, but they can't be called a first or an aliyah and things like that. There's a case in the five towns of a couple. Their first two children are kohanim, and the last two children are not kohanim. What happened was that they were married and they got divorced. And they had a child who died, unfortunately, and at the funeral they came back together, and you know, tragedy brings people together, and they got remarried. They didn't care what the rabbi said. I guess they went to a conservative rabbi, and they're in the Orthodox community, and the marriage is a valid marriage, and they have children, and two of them are not kohanim. The conservatives started dealing with this in the 50s. If you look in what's the name of the conservative rabbi, help me out here, wrote the Code of Jewish Law. He was a rabbi
Klein,
in Buffalo.
Klein.
Isaac Klein. Isaac Klein
was a rabbi in Buffalo.
yeah, a big Talmud Chacham who came from Yeshiva University. He has a responsum on this, and from then, I'm sure even before his responsum, people looked the other way, because at the end of the day, it's a valid marriage. And if the person wants to give up his rights to be a Kohen, it's a valid marriage. But we're not allowed to do that, but ex post facto, it's okay. And this obviously rubbed people the wrong way, so they went along with it. So the first impression, I think, most people, in fact, most people listening to us right now and in the future, would be that obviously the woman can't be converted when the husband's a Kohen. Because this, by converting the woman, we're creating a situation where she's then going to marry someone and violate halacha. How can we convert someone so that dafka, she can then go and violate halacha? It's one thing when we don't know what they're going to do, but here we know. The whole point of the conversion is so that they can be married. In Hoffman's case, it was a little more complicated, because the couple had a child, and the baby died after circumcision. And the woman had felt that the reason the baby died was because she was not Jewish. And she said that she wanted to be married, converted, and married in Jewish ceremony so that she was, or this bad luck wouldn't strike her. And in this case, the Beit Din was told that the woman was really going to have a nervous breakdown, and I mean, these are side issues, but they come to play. Again, halacha's halacha. And already the Rambam said in the Mor Nevuchim that every legal system you're going to have people suffer. But that's in the name of the larger good. And here too, there's a larger idea at stake. So individuals are going to suffer. You can't change halacha. Yet, Rav David Hoffman is not so sure. To begin with, he raises the question, what is worse? For a Kohen to marry a convert, or for him to remain living with, married to, a Christian? Since it is clearly worse for a Kohen to be married to a Christian, for anyone to be married to a Christian, this would lead you, he thinks, that we should convert the woman. It's the lesser of two evils. Now, then he raises the problem, which everyone's thinking, well, still, how can you, yes, it's the lesser of two evils, but how can we convert someone? The whole point of conversion is to follow Torah, if the point of the conversion is precisely to violate halacha, and she's going to have to divorce her husband immediately. Hoffman says, and this gets back to Rabbi Kelman's point, he analyzes, what does it mean, acceptance of the Torah? Does it mean that you need to follow the entire Torah, or does it mean you need to accept the Torah? Hoffman says that, remember, this is what the Rambam says, we tell them what the halacha is, what the Torah is, we tell them some halachot, we could even tell them in this case that it's forbidden. They don't, and they need to say, we accept the Torah. Whether they do or not is not our concern. And whether the person, and this is how you had all these conversions in Israel, where the people were really not Shomrei Torah and Mitzvos. And we're going to see Rav Uziel elaborates in great length on this. It's a technical thing. We need to tell them what the Torah is. They need to accept the Torah. If deep down they don't accept the Torah, or if they do accept the Torah, but their attitude is, like that case in Long Island, yes, I accept the Torah, but I'm willing to violate this sin, this one-time event, in the name of, my family. There's larger issues at stake here. People do things like this all the time. We don't tell people who are intermarried, who are becoming religious, divorce your wife. We try to find ways around it. We try to convert the person, because we recognize in the real world, things don't always work so clearly. According to Hoffman, whether the person accepts all the laws is not our concern. It's not the Beit Din's concern. If the person says, I do not accept the Torah, if the person even says, I don't accept this law, we cannot convert them. However, if the person says they accept the Torah, and even if the person says, I accept the laws, but is not intent on doing it, we don't ask questions. That's not the Beit Din's job. She goes, and then she, even in a case like this, where we know she's going to live with him, that's the whole point of the conversion. Nevertheless, the Malamed Ohel says, we don't need to ask questions because that doesn't void the conversion. Yes, normally we'll never do a conversion like this. We don't want to do conversions for people. If someone comes to us and we know he's going to be Mechal Shabbos, we're not going to convert him. Even though the conversion would be valid, we won't convert him. But this is a special case where for the sake of the future children and for the sake of the man, we can go to strict halacha. And in strict halacha, the only thing that matters is mila, tevila in the mikvah, and the words saying that I accept the Torah. What he does afterwards, he's a sinning Jew. As soon as he converts and he violates the law, he's a sinning Jew like every other Jew, and he needs to do tshuva. But it's a valid conversion, 100%. That's the Malam al-Holos position. This is the position, as I said, was specifically rejected by both the Rav and Rav Moshe Feinstein, that we cannot... This is not talking about conversions in general, because Rav Moshe also, in his later years, had a pretty liberal position. But when you convert someone knowing that they're going to violate a law, and the whole point of the conversion is to enable them to violate the law, they said you cannot do that. That doesn't mean they said the conversion is invalid. What they said is that you cannot do such a conversion. I think they would also agree that ex post facto it's a valid conversion. This used to be a very common approach to conversion. Okay, we're going to get to the excellent question. What about if it's a marriage? First of all, it's not an Avera every second of the marriage. The question is, how can you do what to do with the marriage? It's not an Avera. It's an Avera one time when you marry the person, then you violate the law. After that, that's fine. You don't need to divorce. Well, you don't need to. Do you need to divorce the person? Once you're a halal, you don't even need to divorce the person. Correct me if I'm wrong. You've already lost your status. Whether you divorce, there might be some mila of divorcing the person, but you don't get your status back, and you can live like this. It's not like other situations. It's not like a Mamzerus case. But I will look into that if there's even a mila, because the lashon of the Rambam and all this is that if once you convert, we don't force, you don't have to... In similar cases, you don't have to convert, but I will look into that for next week. Is there a notion of divorcing? Because you've lost your status of a Kohen. I'll make a note of this. I mean, you can look around. I'm sure there's plenty of people in the firm world today who are Balei Tshuva, who when they convert, they're married to Kohanim. Do we tell them to get divorced? I mean, Kohanim, who are married to people they shouldn't be married to, do we tell them to get divorced? There was a case with Ramosha where someone converted, and in a case just like this, and he told the person to they can already be married, and they accepted it. However, what about people who have already been married, and then they become Balei Tshuva? I've never heard of a case, and there's plenty of people who are Kohanim, and then they become from. And they're married to a divorcee. That we tell them to get divorced. I don't know. Anyone know of cases like that? I've never heard of anything like that. You said you think so. I'll ask. I will ask. I know someone who's very involved in Kiruv. He has. He's one of the Lakewood people. And I'll ask him. Do they ever do such a thing like that? I've never heard it. And certainly, there's room not to say that. I mean, the whole point of them becoming religious is. And we'll see Ramosha Malka in next semester. Ramosha Malka and Petel Tikva specifically said you don't tell them that they have to separate. I guess there's room. Although the fact that Ramosha Malka dealt with it, obviously that people say you should separate. But he said you don't have to. So look, I'll look into that. Yeah, I mean, the method, usually it never comes to be practical because you look into the, if it's a non-religious person, Ramosha always had the assumption that the yichus is not a valid yichus. So it almost never came to be. It could be, I have to check it in, it could be that it's more than just a mila. It could be that there's a real halachic shita you need to separate. The fact, now that I think of it, the fact that Ramosha Malka is arguing so against the idea that you do separate, that leads me to believe that obviously other poskim say you should. But even if that's the halacha, lamaisa, do people do that? Do rabbis tell congregants? I don't know. I find it hard to believe in today's day and age. But I'll look into it. Now, the approach I described with the W.C. Hoffman used to be a very popular approach, especially in Israel. And we'll see this with Rav Uziel, that we convert them because of the sake of the children. Rav W.C. Hoffman was also concerned with something that we saw Hildesheimer was not at all concerned with, that they might go and be converted by the non-Orthodox rabbi, and that'll lead to problems with Yichus. So it's better for the Orthodox to convert them. Now, what about the problem raised by, is it Arez or Erez? What about the marriage? Everyone agrees, even if we do convert them, we can't marry them. The only question which was being raised then was, what do you do if they're already married? Do we have to, obviously, if they become immediate tzaddikim, they shouldn't be in such a marriage. But is there really a halachic issue that you have to try to push? them to and say you're really not a Balshuva unless you. That's the only issue that's debate. I know it's debatable, but I'll try to find out more details next class. But l'chatchila, to do a marriage, how can you do a marriage? The rabbi can't perform such a marriage. We all know that. So what to do? Rav W. C. Hoffman says that in such a case, we let them live as a civil marriage. She is his pilegus. She is his concubine. Remember, it was worse when he was married to the non-Jew. We now convert her. Under normal circumstances, they'd get married. However, in this case, they can't get married. Therefore, we permit them to live in a civil marriage. Normally, we don't permit gilag shim, concubinage. That's not the Torah approach anymore, although in medieval times they did so. But this is an emergency case, and therefore we allow them to live. And really, at the end of the day, it's an argument. Most early authorities, most Rishonim, hold that there's nothing wrong with having a concubine, as long as the laws of family life are adhered to. Don't try telling that to people today, but the Rambam says you can't, but the Ramban disagrees, the Raivad. Most Rishonim, including most Achronim, believe that there's nothing wrong with having a concubine, and it doesn't violate the heter of the Gzer of Rabbeinu Gershom. And here, Rav Zalman Hoffman says, we permit them to live as in concubinage. Obviously, in a normal community that's not healthy, we wouldn't permit it, but here we do permit it. And this is the heter that Rav Shlomo Goren relied upon in an identical case called the Seidman case. This is the heter that Rav Moshe Malka and Israel relied on for a couple that became frum, and they were living in Bnei Brak, and then they were told that they were involved with each other. They weren't already married, and they became frum together, and he said they could live in as concubines. That wasn't the case, though, where they're already married. If they're already married, for him, it was obvious. You don't separate them, I believe. But I'll look into that. As with so much else in Orthodoxy, the halachot of conversion, though, have become much more stringent. When Rav Moshe Pleinstein came to America, he was very stringent. You can see a development in his tshuvot. By the end, he's writing how he understands why a lot of the rabbi, he's malamed zchus. He justifies a lot of the rabbis who are very liberal. Even though that's not his own way, he says you shouldn't speak bad about them, because there are halachic opinions. However, today matters have become much more stringent. And as I said, the standard, they usually use the language of that the standards have been raised, but I don't think that that's a proper approach, because Rav Zalman Hoffman didn't have low standards. I mean, he was the posek acharon. He was a greater posek than any of the people today going around talking about raising standards. He was the authoritative posek of the whole country. We don't have anyone like that today. Virtually everyone accepted him as the final word, and yet, so you're not going to say that someone like that had low standards. However, he believed that in certain cases, we need to go lakula, leniently, in order to secure other important values. That is, Jewish family life. We don't want to give up on any Jew. And the Beis Din should have leniencies in order to save these people. Obviously, if you're in a Haredi community, you don't have any connection to these people. It's easy to be stringent. But when you're in a community that is seeing intermarriage at enormous rates, and that was the situation in Germany, you see what's going on. It's no different than a rabbi in a small town in America, not so much in the big cities where you don't have these issues for Orthodox rabbis, but an Orthodox rabbi in a small town where he still has old-time Orthodox Jews that aren't that observant, people are coming to him all the time with their children who are dating non-Jews. So what do you do in a case like that? Whether Rav Zalman Hoffman is still valid today, whether the Batei Din in America will accept it, obviously these are questions that need to be asked. But this was, it's not just Rav Zalman Hoffman, we'll see this is Rav Uziel, this is Rav Shlomo Goren, this was many, this was the chief rabbinate of Israel for many years. Their approach was, in Israel, we make it very easy for conversion, we don't make it hard. His tshuvot were not published in his lifetime. He died, and his notebooks were published after his death in about three volumes, immediately after his death, put out by Rav Avraham Eliel Kaplan. So there wasn't, you didn't have the opportunity for the other post-scheme to debate it, but if all you have to do is look at the literature since his lifetime, and you see that there's great debate, pro and con, and there is a school of Psak that follows this, although it is not, it never was the dominant school, and it certainly today is very out of style. Although I wonder what gives a person today the right to say that such a gerus, b'diavad, after the fact, is not a valid gerus, when we have so many important authorities who permitted that. Okay, here we end with from W.T. Hoffman. We'll have a good 15 minutes or so dealing with Mara Tzvayev, unless anyone has any other questions on, I mean, this goes so much against the grain, especially the understanding of what Kabbalah Samitzvos is. Today we have a very different understanding. We make people go to classes for a whole year to study. Rabbi Kiva Eger said this is all forbidden, all these classes, because you're not allowed to teach a non-Jew Torah. So what is it, when a non-Jew wants to convert, it's because they know a little bit about what Judaism is, they know monotheism, and then they convert, and then we begin teaching them. Torah is a lifetime process. But the idea that we have today, that we give them classes, and we educate them and all this, according to Rabbi Kiva Eger, it's all usher. That's not, and if you look in the Rambam, in the Shulchan Aruch, what is it? You tell them a few small laws and a few big laws, and you immediately convert them. That's the Lashon of the Rambam. You immediately convert them. And then, of course, they convert. They know nothing. They know Shemir Shabbos Kol Chasa. You know, the whole volume. They don't know any of these laws. But they're like every other Jew. They need to learn. And not knowing the laws does not invalidate the conversion. Not accepting the laws, that invalidates it. And then, of course, the issue we mentioned, what does that mean not to accept it? After all, someone who hardly knows any halachot, in what sense can you really say he's accepting the Torah? But we see from the Rambam, you don't really need to know very much. You just need to have a general understanding of what it means to be Jewish.
And accept the Yitzhak Malikari.
Today, many people would say that, yes, that except the Yud Gimel Karim, although the Rambam doesn't say that. The Rambam says we teach them certain basic principles of faith, and if you look in the Mishnah Torah, he never lists the 13 Ikarim. That's why Rav Gorin and others claim that he abandoned his principles as a absolute. That truthfully, if you count them up, there's like 23 principles in the Mishnah Torah. But again, in terms of principles, I don't know what they require, and I don't know what... in detail. Every Beis Din would be different. Some Batei Din, so they give them Chaim Donin's book to be a Jew. They tell them to read this, and then that's pretty much it when it comes to philosophy, because how can someone who doesn't really know anything understand what Ikari Amunah are anyway? So, but these are issues that are now being fought out in Israel and in America, and if you follow the Orthodox world, you know that this is a big fight, because as Rabbi Hirsch pointed out a few minutes ago, it's also being used. These raising of standards, so to speak, is not just being used for pure halakhic reasons. It's a way to delegitimize the RCA, to delegitimize RCA rabbis, and to delegitimize people who believe in modern science. They had Rav Chaim Konevsky to say that if you believe in an ancient universe, you can't be a Dayan, and you can't be converted either. So there's a power play going on here as well. Yes, and Rabbi Angel has written a lot about this, and he sees himself as following Rav Uziel. Okay, so if nothing, no more, we'll move on to another very important figure. That is Ritzi Hirsch Chayes, who, as far as I know, doesn't really speak about, I don't think he has any tshuvot on conversion, because it wasn't really an issue. It was so far removed. Meeting a convert in Eastern Europe, such a thing hardly ever happened. You had some famous converts. You had the famous convert in Vilna, but it was so unusual. Why would anyone want to convert to be part of a persecuted class? So you had different issues. Now, the first three figures we spoke about this semester, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Rav Israel Hildesheimer, Rav W.T. Hoffman, they were in Germany, where modernity comes on the scene. So obviously we see them as precursors to what we talk about when we say modern orthodoxy. As we know already, we've said it again and again, that doesn't mean that everything that so-called modern orthodoxy today accepts, that they accepted, and when you say so-called modern orthodoxy, there's different modern Orthodox rabbis with different opinions. There's no one idea. But they set the tone in all the things we've spoken about. There's other rabbis in Germany we didn't discuss. Maybe in future classes we'll discuss them. You have the Matthei Levi in Frankfurt. You have Rav Nobel. There's other important figures as well. But I thought it would also be worthwhile to look at another figure who, in a sense, is also a precursor of modern Orthodoxy. And he comes not from Germany, but from Galicia, and that's from Zvi Hirsch Chayes. Galicia, like Poland, between Poland and the Ukraine, that area, that's Galicia. Chayes is often described as a conservative Maskil, and he's best known for his commentary on the Talmud. Those who have the Vilna Shas in the back of all the volumes, you have the writings of the Maariv Chayes, on Talmud. And if you look at his writings, you see that they're not like other commentaries. They're concerned with historical issues. they're concerned with academic study of Talmud in a very primitive sense, but he also wrote many other writings. If you're interested, you can get, there's two big volumes, Kol Sifrei Maaretz Chayos, one of his writings has been translated into English, so a very important figure. But first, let's talk about his biography, and for those who are interested in more, let me tell you about two interesting books. First, you have this. It's called Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Chayos. Here's a picture of him on the back. It was written, if anyone went to Yeshiva University, you might know the late Dr. Maya Hershkowitz. Here's his picture. This book first came out in the 1970s, Mossad Rav Kook. It was reprinted last year by Mossad Rav Kook, and it is full of information, learned and erudite footnotes, and yet you don't really get the forest because of all the trees. There's so much information in there. A much better work, which has never appeared in book form, is a doctoral dissertation. You can get the doctoral dissertation, authored by a woman named Bruja Huttner David. And it really is much better than what Hershkowitz is long in the footnotes, but you missed the larger picture. This is Rav Huttner's daughter. In the 1960s, she was a doctoral student at the Columbia University. She got a PhD, an excellent PhD on the Maaretz Chayos. And after that, I don't know what became of her. She went off to Israel. She became like a Rosh Yeshiva, if you can use that term, for girls' schools. And she's an influential figure in the Haredi world. And I think today she doesn't want anyone to know about her doctoral dissertation and some of the stuff she says. I mean, she proves, to my satisfaction, at least in the Maaretz Chayos, did not believe the Zohar was written in by Rashbi, that it was a later work. I mean, so she obviously was a different person in those days and very learned, and I'm sure she reviewed all this with her father, who, of course, is one of the Gedolim in America and another figure we need to deal with. So you have two major works on the Maaretz Chayos, Breuer Huttner's biography, or under Sal Baron, doctoral dissertation under the great Sal Baron. I'm assuming it was under him because it was the Jewish history, and he was the head of Jewish history. And Yerushalmi wasn't there in those days. He was the only figure in Jewish history there at Columbia, so it must have been under her, and also the late Meir Hershkowitz. There you go. Okay, so you have a PDF. I also have it on PDF. And she doesn't like Maaretz Chayos very much. You could see that, I think. And I spoke to one of her Futner's Talmidim, and it clearly came from her father. Her father didn't like, apparently, the Maaretz Chayos. And you see this in some... I mean, she feels it's okay for her to talk about how Maaretz Chayos doesn't know what he's talking about in places, and okay, but that's a study of her, per se, but it's a very good work. Now, crucial to understanding the Maaretz Chayos, when we say Maaretz Chayos, that's how he's known in yeshiva world. Mara stands for Moreno Harav Tzvi Chayos. That's how, because if you look at his tshuvot, his responsa, or his notes in the Talmud, he's called the Maaretz Chayos. Some sages are called like Rambam, Rabbeinu Moshe. Others begins with the Mem. You have the Marsha, the Maharaman. He's the Maaretz Chayos. I don't know why he was worthy of having the Mem in front of his name, but that's how we'll refer to him. C-H-A-J-E-S. It's an old family. It goes back actually to Portugal. And the Chayos are very proud of their Sephardic descent. In general, Ashkenazim like to look to the Sephardim as being more open-minded and more liberal. And Ishmael Shorsh has an article about this, the myth of Sephardi supremacy. Now, crucial to understanding Maaretz Chayos is the Haskalah. What is the Haskalah? It means different things in different people to different people. Haskalah means enlightenment. And if you read Haredi literature, it often gets a bad rap. Mendelssohn was a Maskil, and in many places, in particular Germany, Haskalah led to irreligiosity, no question about it. But in other places, this was not the case. Certainly, as I said, German Orthodoxy, I said this when we first dealt with Hirsch, if I recall correctly, German Orthodoxy is an outgrowth of Haskalah to a certain extent. Hirsch's father was influenced by Haskalah. What is Haskalah about? It's about involving yourself in the outside world, getting advanced secular educations. German Orthodoxy is a development of Haskalah, and they saw themselves as following in the path of Mendelssohn. In Lithuania, you had a conservative Haskalah, where you had pious Jews, that is, Jews with long beards, completely Shomer Torah Mitzvos, who believed that Jews needed to break out of the ghetto, be more open-minded, be more educated, maybe go into agriculture. get maybe white-collar professions, that this wasn't the approach of that Jews should be living in the modern world. The Nitziv, for example, was very close to many Maskilim. He read Haskalah newspapers. In fact, he had moderate Haskalah tendencies. If you look at the writings, he writes commentaries on works that no one else does. The Halachic Midrashim. He's interested in all sorts of academic type stuff that we would call academic today, in Halachic Midrash and historical stuff. He's interested in the Hebrew grammar, things of that nature that are associated with Haskalah. Certainly the Torah Tamima is in that camp. You have many, many people. Gil Pearl, I believe he's now in Memphis, who graduated Harvard 2 years ago, PhD on the Nitziv. He speaks about this whole, the Nitziv and his the influence of Haskalah on his relationship. In Vilna, you had all sorts of religious maskilim, and in Kovno you had them, etc. In Galicia, however, which, as I said, is really southeast Poland, northwest Ukraine, the Haskalah was marked by irreligiosity, opposition to Torah, and leading figures, Galician maskilim, who were really against, sometimes they claim that they were only against the fanatical rabbis, the fanatical Hasidim, but really they were against Torah, and they wanted to create a reform type of Judaism in Galicia. But there were religious maskilim as well there. Chayas is hardly unique. Let me mention two other names. Men who were more liberal in their viewpoints than the Maritz Chayas, but totally observant. One was Nachman Krochmal, author of Mor Nebuchadnezzar, and the other was Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, the chief rabbi of Prague, becomes the chief rabbi of Prague, the son-in-law of the Ketzos HaChoshen. They become maskilim, they become enemies for the Hasidim. The Hasidim hated them, they hated the Hasidim. But really, to a large extent, these are very modern Orthodox type of figures who are stuck in an area where everyone else is traditional Orthodox, and that creates all sorts of problems with them. The Chassam Sofer, this is one of the mysteries. Why was the Chassam Sofer so friendly with Rappaport, who's known by the acronym Shir? Greenwald, in his book on the Hungarian Orthodox, he thinks that the Maritz, that Chassam Sofer wanted to prevent Shir, that is Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, from going off the deep end. And therefore he remained in good ties with him to at least keep him in the Torah camp. Because people like Shir did have radical tendencies, but they lived as complete from Jews. He was the Abbasid in Prague, with liberal ideas, no question about it. Certainly Krochmal. All of these men believed in wide-ranging educations, and to study the history of Halakha and Talmud with a critical eye. Because in modern times, you need to study things critically. You need to study things historically. It's a lishma for them. It's that this is, Torah's not about, it's about truth. And we can't hide our heads in the sand. We spoke about this already with Hoffman. Now let me give you the biographical background, go for another 3 minutes. Maritz Chayas was born in 1805 in Brody, which is in Galicia. He did not live very long. He died in 1856, only 51 years. He was a student in Brody of the Rav of Brody, the Beis Ephraim, Rav Ephraim Zalman Margolios. The Beis Ephraim is one of the great poskim in Galicia. He's best known probably because he got in a huge dispute with Rav Yaakov of Karlin, the Mishkanos Yaakov, over Erevin. And all the Erevin we have today rely on the Beis Ephraim's understanding of Erevin. We're talking about cities of any size. And the Mishkanos Yaakov, he was against Erevin. So it's a huge machlokas. His father, though, that is the father of the Maritz Chayas, arranged for him to get a secular education. Where would his father get this? Well, aside from the fact that he had maskilim in Galicia, his father had lived in Italy for a while. And in Italy, maybe we'll have a session, not next semester, a future semester, on Italy. In Italy, they didn't have this extremism. You can see this going back hundreds and hundreds of years. Look, the Sforno, in what, the 15th century, or 15th century, he's already teaching Hebrew to non-Jewish professors, was very involved. All the Italian rabbanim were very open-minded and involved in secular society. So when Maritz Chayas' father lives in Italy, is it any surprise that he comes back and believes that his children should get wide-ranging educations? And the Maritz Chayas was taught languages, French, and and here's something else I learned from Hutner David's dissertation to show you how open-minded he is. What other Gadol B'Yisrael, certainly in the 19th century, would ever cite the Quran in his writings. But the Maharskaya cites the Quran. He's trying to make an historical point. He's trying to prove something. So he knows the Quran. I don't think the other Gedolim ever heard of the Quran. I mean, so here you're already, you're dealing with a very interesting and unusual figure, and it's already 10 o'clock. So next class, and I believe we'll be able to do the whole Maharskaya in one class. We'll have to, even though there's some very interesting stuff. We will pick up with him, the great sage of Galicia, Maharskaya. Talk about his relationships to the Hasidim, because some Hasidim still have negative views about him. But that'll be next class. Does anyone have further comments?
Next class we'll be taking live from Toronto. Is Mark going to be here for the Association of Jewish Studies conference? I figured I'd pass that along.
Yeah. Okay. Any other comments or questions? On Mars, someone's typing something, I think. Okay, well, if not, then we will pick up next class, and I will get in. I will find out this information about what the poskim today do when people become Balei Tshuva and they're involved in a marriage that ab initio should never have been carried out. But thank you very much. Till next week. Bye bye.
Thanks. Okay. Good night.
This program is brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more recordings like this, visit www.torahinmotion.org.